Oftentimes, it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And I should say that we are not recording from the studio today due to COVID protocols. I'm at home, Dan is in his office, and our guest will be remote as well.
Hello, Denise. Do you belong, Pope?
I hope I belong. I'd like to think I belong.
I was thinking about, in preparation for our guest, who is the world's expert on belonging and its psychological benefits for learning, I was thinking about my own experience of belonging. And so in high school, I was the guy who was sort of friends with every group, but I didn't have my own group, right? And there was this group of guys that was just so cool. And they all wore colored corduroys and like penny loafers and like Lacoste shirts, you know, the shirts that are sort of cable knit and have an alligator on them. So one day I came to school dressed like that to see, would I belong? Did the group accept me? It didn't work. In fact, they didn't even bother to laugh at me to my face. It just, they gave me nothing. Now I have had the last laugh. They're all balding and overweight, and I'm not. Not that there's anything wrong with balding and overweight, mind you. That's fine. But you know, maybe if I had belonged to that group with the corduroys, I would have had a different fate.
Interesting.
But it hurt. You know, it hurt. And I wanted to belong, and I didn't. And, you know, I scrambled around it. How about you, Denise? You belong everywhere you go.
No.
No time you're ever left out.
No, totally, totally not true. No, I had a little group. I did have my own sort of group. So I wasn't like you bopping around. I sort of had my place where I would go and eat lunch, and I knew my people would be there for me. Right. And we called ourselves the Geeks. But it was in calling ourselves the Geeks, we were pretending to not be as nerdy as the other group who were the true nerds. So I don't know if it really worked. They might have thought that we were the true nerds. But I can tell you, even within that group, you know, you think you have this sort of stable group, you eat lunch with them every day, it's all looking good. And then you don't get invited to the sleepover. And I remember, and this was so painful, and I think it was either last year of middle school or first year of high school. These were people who I thought were really good friends of mine. And I found out about the sleepover, and I was devastated. And of course, it turns out that her mom said she could only invite three friends or whatever it was. But the fact that I wasn't considered one of those three, look, I still remember to this day.
Wow.
And I remember exactly who was invited and exactly who wasn't. Ooh. So yeah, it's painful.
Boy, it's impressive how these memories stick. You know, my closet has like five pairs of colored corduroys and penny loafers. So I never forget.
But every time you walk by, you
yeah,
think,
every time. Oh God.
But I have hair. But I have hair now. Yeah, no, belonging is a serious thing.
No, it is so basic. So I want to introduce our guest who's really going to help us understand it beyond our own pain of having been left out. So it's my pleasure to introduce Jeffrey Cohen. Jeff is a professor in education, psychology, and by courtesy in business at Stanford. He's one of those guys. He belongs to every group. You know, his research examines the processes that shape people's sense of belonging. And he also studies the threats to belonging that people encounter at work and school and strategies to make more inclusive spaces. And his new book is called Belonging, and it is forthcoming. And he's going to give me a signed copy when it comes out. So welcome, Jeff. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Dan and Denise. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
So
you feel like I belong.
You do amongst us for sure.
I don't know. Show me your shoes.
So I should have worn my corduroys. I actually have some.
And they still fit. So give a prototypical instance of belonging and of not belonging, so people can sort of locate the construct.
Mm. Well, a prototypical example of belonging versus not belonging. That's interesting. I mean, I've kind of defined it as the sense that you are accepted and respected in a domain. It could be at work or at school, that sense that you're accorded a full measure of respect and regard by the people that are in your group or that are in your workplace or school. And a prototypical example of that might be let me take a step back. Like, one of the things that we've been interested in is how the experience of being socially marginalized or stereotyped can undermine that sense of feeling like you belong or feeling that you're respected, even in situations where nobody may be thinking that of you. And we've called that a sort of sense of belonging uncertainty, where people you're kind of in the situation where you don't know for sure if this is a place where you'll be regarded positively or not. And because of the stereotype, that sort of question of belonging is on your mind.
So if you're totally on guard all the time, it's taking away from your ability to learn, feel comfortable. It's causing anxiety. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, that's right. You're if you feel like your belonging's on trial, and you're wondering if this is a place where you're regarded favorably, it's hard to be fully present. And there's research that suggests it takes up working memory. People are kind of having this kind of inner rumination, wondering like, what are people thinking of me? Or do they believe in me? And all that kind of cognitive energy that we put into those kinds of questions of belonging is kind of mental energy taken away from learning, focusing, performing, growing.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. And we're talking with Jeff Cohen about the concept of belonging and just how critical it is.
So does, in addition to the psychological or the purely mental phenomenon, I assume if you feel like you don't belong, you don't approach, you stay away. Or do you keep trying?
I think that there's almost sort of two kinds of orientations you can have in any social situation. One is to kind of be on guard in a sort of self-protective defensive state. And in that stage, you're kind of avoiding threats, right? You don't want to be in a situation where your sense of adaptive adequacy or self-integrity could come under threat. So you avoid challenge. You have a kind of prevention, what's called a prevention focus. You want to sort of prevent further losses to face and respect your own sense of respect. And then the other mode is a kind of sort of engagement in the situation where people are, the self-protective question is kind of off the table. And people are kind of engaged. They take advantage of opportunities. They are trying to learn, trying to contribute. And that sort of second focus is more likely to occur when we feel we belong, when we have that sense that, okay, whether I fit in here is to some degree kind of off the table. And now I can kind of focus less on the task of self-protection and more the task of sort of contributing, learning, and growing. So I think and that's more of a kind of promotion focus. It's known as a promotion focus.
It's so interesting because as you're talking, I am thinking about middle school, and middle schoolers, like, the worst thing in the world is to be different, right? And like, you try to belong. And so you try to wear the clothes. It's sort of like Dan with the corduroys, yeah. Right? And you eat the same food and, oh my gosh, don't be the person with the weird lunch. Right. And just, they never get to that point of thinking, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, I'm okay here. Like it's just so fraught.
Yeah. The teenage years in particular are fraught in that way. The questions of belonging loom so large there. And a lot of research suggests that's a real period of identity formation. And kids are very, very sensitive to social rewards, how they're being seen by others. So it is a really, I think your instincts are right. It's a really fraught time. I know from my own experience, you know, which is very resonant with what Dan said and what you described of these very painful sort of flashbulb memories of rejection and feeling like an outcast that just kind of stick with you. And I think the teenage years are kind of sort of fraught with those threats to belonging.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking today with Jeff Cohen about the importance of belonging and how hard it is when you're a teen, especially, but even some adults, I know, right? It's just, even as we come out of COVID, right? If people are like, how do I talk to people again? What if, you know, they haven't seen me? I look different. I lost my hair. I gained weight, you know, to go back to Dan's analogy. it's tough.
So Denise, I'm going to be part of the truly nerdy group that you made fun of.
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
This is with a question for Jeff. Okay. So Jeff, do belonging and mindset come from the same psychological mechanism? And it might be something like what you believe shapes what you learn. Like Spinoza, I think he was the first one on this. You know, you can be in prison and still be free in your head. Mm-hmm. And so he put all the weight on the internal your belief state.
Yeah, it's such a great question. I mean, I'm a social psychologist, so I study the power of the situation and how that affects how we think, feel, and behave. And for me, this distinction between what's inside your head and what's outside in the situation is really, really fuzzy, really fuzzy. Mm-hmm. I think so much of our mindset is shaped by the kinds of situations we're in. And if you're in that kind of situation that you described earlier in the show, where you feel like you are an outcast to some degree, you don't have the corduroy pants, and people are kind of seeing you or treating you in a bit of a kind of distancing way. Then from that, a mindset develops oftentimes of, well, I actually don't feel like I fully belong here. It is a quest. It becomes a question of the mind. And it comes from the situation you're in. But once you're in that situation, the mind takes over and tells yourself that this is a question I got to think about in this sort of situation, like school, for instance, but also at work. And if we experience enough slights or enough ostracism, and it doesn't even have to be severe. Like it could be these little sins of omission where we're just not given credit, for instance, or we don't feel appreciated. If we experience enough of that, then you could call it a mindset, but a sort of question of belonging sort of starts to consume our mind. And we're just kind of wondering, is this a place where I can fit in, where I can belong? And at some point we might eventually decide, I don't want to deal with that question anymore. We might disidentify from the situation or exit it entirely, or leave, as you did, kind of grow up, you know, become an adult, leave those folks behind. And then the question kind of subsides. But I think it's a question we're always asking ourselves in many situations. And it partly comes from the situations we're in.
The reason I go after your beliefs is you've done these interventions that are really short, you know, where people write positive thoughts about belonging on postcards, things like that. And they have these long-term consequences.
Yeah,
that's hard to attribute to any change in the environment. So it sort of sounds like, you changed their beliefs for a moment about themselves, and somehow that stuck. And how do you get these long-term effects if the environment around them isn't changing, or maybe it does?
That's a great question. I mean, the environment is changing through the interventions that we do. We do these brief activities where, for example, in that perilous transition to seventh grade, when a lot of kids are kind of wondering about these kinds of questions of belonging and identity, the teacher distributes a worksheet for the kids, asking them, what do you stand for? What are your most important values? And why are they important to you? And so that, from the student doesn't know that that's an intervention. These are the interventions the researchers designed, but through the teacher administered to the kids. But from the student's perspective, that's a huge change to their situation, I think. It's my teacher is asking me about something that I really care deeply about. And it's a sign that they're interested in me and they want to get to know me better in part. And then when the student engages with the activity and starts writing about their most important values, it's true. It does have all kinds of psychological effects. People from a lot of research that my colleagues have done, writing about an important value that you hold, such as relationships, or could be work, could be career, oftentimes it's family. The act of doing that can be really self-clarifying. People kind of get a sort of wider perspective on who they are and what matters to them, which then in turn makes a stressful situation where you might feel like you don't quite fit in and belong a little more tolerable, a little sort of less stress inducing. And people sort of hang in there a little longer. But you're right, through those kinds of activities, we found like very short psychological experiences, powerful experiences of connection, of self-regard, such as that values affirmation intervention, can have these long-range effects. But I believe that they do in part by changing the experience situation, the situation of students living it in the classroom.
So if I do an intervention to help children feel like they belong, but it's an incredibly hostile environment,
yeah,
it's just not going to stick, right? Because the environment's not going to pick up on their desire to be more engaged. It won't help them keep it going.
Yeah, I think that's right. We like these kinds of activities to on-ramps to belonging. A lot of times you're just wondering if you can fit in, you're not sure, and it's kind of hard to take that first step through the door. And at these key transitions, like the transition to adolescence or middle school, these kinds of interventions or activities can be, you know, kind of welcome. You know, we welcome you here. We want to know more about you. But then it's one of the worst things in the world to feel like that's just you're just being burned. You're betrayed. Like that's a false gesture. And so I do think that the activities depend for their effects on there being a kind of reasonable infrastructure of teachers and staff there to welcome the student and support them once they start to feel at ease.
So Jeff, if I'm a teacher and I'm teaching seventh grade, I want my kids to feel like they belong. What's a very concrete sort of effective thing that I could do?
Yeah, well, there's a suite of interventions and this is work done by folks like Greg Walton and David Jaeger and other Valpurdy Greenaway throughout the country. There's a few of them now that have accumulated. They're referred to as WISE interventions. One is asking students about their values, as we just talked about, giving kids these sort of structured moments throughout school to reflect on what's most important to them in their lives and why. So that's one. These are what we refer to as values affirmation activities that come out of the research of Claude Steele. A second is what we refer to as wise criticism. So one of the challenges in being an educator or a mentor is to deliver criticism in a way that kind of conveys the information, the corrective information to the student, but doesn't threaten their sense of belonging or motivation. And one of the things that we found that can be very effective for that is when you're given critical feedback, to say it's coming from my high standards and my belief in your potential to reach them. We found that when you give critical feedback in this way, in many contexts, it's not only more likely to be listened to and complied with. We've even found years and years later, the students who get that kind of criticism from their teacher expressing a belief in their potential are more likely to go on to college, at least for members of underrepresented groups such as African Americans. So getting this sort of timely moment or this kind of moment of connection where your teacher says, hey, I'm giving you this critical feedback because I really have high hopes for you, can have these long-term and sometimes life-changing impacts, we found, under the right circumstances.
Super interesting. Thank you, Jeff. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Jeff Cohen and some interventions to help amplify and promote belonging next on Sirius XM.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So it is hard to predict what the future will be.
The focus is really on academics.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Jeff Cohen all about the topic of belonging and just how important it is. And right before the break, Jeff, you were mentioning this intervention where when a teacher is giving feedback to a student, or anyone's giving feedback to anybody, if you say that it's coming from a place of high standards, it's more likely to be more productive. And I just want to kind of tease that out. Is the opposite of that, that someone will say, oh, she doesn't like me, or, oh, I shouldn't be here, or I'm not up to speed, I'm dumb, I don't belong. Is that why that high standards line works?
Yes, that's right. I think in a lot of cases in these sorts of situations, in many social situations, there's just a lot of ambiguity. especially in these situations where we're getting critical feedback, but in almost any situation where we're trying to succeed and thrive, there's just a lot of ambiguity about what the, about why people are treating us the way they are. And with, in the case of criticism, one big ambiguity is, you know, why is this person giving me critical feedback? Why are they pointing out so many negative things, places where I can improve my work? In situations, especially where there's a kind of a difference, a demographic difference, for instance, a white teacher giving feedback, as is often the case, to a minority student, that ambiguity can be even, it can be amplified. So there's like just more of it. And as a student, I don't know, because the reality of racism or sexism, I don't know if the feedback that I'm getting from this person is genuinely reflective of the quality of my work or is coming from a place of bias. And in that case, I think one of the big lessons of this research is that it's very helpful to sort of dig into why we're giving the criticism, explain explicitly how it's coming from a place of high standards and our belief in the student's potential to reach them.
So belonging is going to be important in many ways, not just my example and Denise's example of clicks, but yeah. I walk into an office environment and it feels hostile to me, yeah. Right? The signs on the walls are just, they're just like, I don't belong. They just convey that. I can go into a situation and I feel as though this is not an environment where I can thrive. Like there won't be promotions for me in this place. You know, women don't get promoted here. And there's all these places to intervene. And I would imagine that interventions don't always work. Like these suggestions. And the thing that's coming to mind is I have friends who have been in therapy for months and months and months.
Yeah.
And it hasn't changed their self-beliefs. How much faith should I put in these interventions? Like, yeah. Is it like my friend who's going to therapy all the time? And I'm yeah. like, sure, it doesn't hurt.
I guess I want to be really, really clear about this, that what we are trying to do in so much of our research is to change situations, lived situations for the better. And the term that we use throughout the book is situation crafting, which is the science and art of constructing classrooms, workplaces, healthcare settings in ways that convey or confer a sense of belonging to as many people from as many walks of life as possible. So I've actually tried generally to avoid the term intervention because it kind of has that feeling of like a shot in the arm. What I think that the studies, what the studies really show is the power of the situation on our psyche and our sense of belonging in so many spheres of social life. So they're not like therapy. We're not kind of going into to change a cognition or remove some mindset that the student has. I really don't think it's that. It's really helping teachers, helping doctors. We go into belonging in all sorts of different domains of social life, schools, workplaces, healthcare centers. What all of these so-called interventions, but I think it's really a better term would be experiences that we're creating for students, for instance, in the classroom or for patients in healthcare settings. What they all do is make the situation a bit more hospitable for a moment. And then over time that can turn into, it's almost like going to a party, right? You go to a party, someone walks you in, welcomes you at the door. You walk in, you feel like you belong. And then if the party is a place where people really, are welcoming individuals and do care to engage with you and aren't biased against you, that party can go a whole lot better than if you come in with a lot of sort of trepidation at first and you're not sure, you're feeling pretty uneasy. But I think likewise, what we're trying to do in all these settings is give people kind of repertoire of strategies and insights that they can use to craft situations that foster belonging for as many people from as many walks of life as possible.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Jeff Cohen about how to make people feel like they belong, how to for the most people possible, really craft that welcoming situation.
Yeah, that was great. That was really clarifying. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. It took me a little while to get started, but that was good. Yeah.
No, that was super helpful. So we're running out of time, and But I need to ask you one tip. If I'm in a situation where I feel like I don't belong, and I probably really do belong, what's the one thing, the tip you can give me? Like, should I breathe? Should I meditate at that moment? Like, is there anything you can do for me?
Is there anything I personally,
you personally, Jeff, need to help Dan Schwartz feel like he belongs at this party where he really does not belong? Okay.
So the answer, Jeff, should be yes, buy my book.
Oh, I got you. Right. You know, the reason I wrote this book is partly because I think everyone is so different. Everyone's an individual. And I found this in my personal life. You have to kind of experiment a whole lot to figure out what works for you. Yeah. I mean, hopefully people will be there to support you. And so one answer to your question is, I think, to form connections and relationships that can help to mitigate belonging uncertainty. I think one good connection, one good relationship, one good mentor, the research and mentoring is pretty powerful here.
So wait. So there's I have to go to events, and yeah. I'm actually fairly socially awkward. So I end up always standing next to the exact same person and talking to them the whole time.
Interesting.
So that's my sort of aberration of the
that individual is holding for you, Dan, a psychological umbrella and shielding you from the threats to belonging that are raining down on you in that situation.
Wow. I need to tell her.
Jeff, I was going to say, wait, who is it? Because it's not me. I could tell you that. Yeah.
Do they provide general services? Are they who?
can we hire them for each other? But you know what that just made me think about is I was told all along, you just need one person, one friend. Like if you're in middle school, you don't need to be part of the in group. You just need one buddy who you can count on, or one mentor, or one teacher who has your back. I think people think of belonging as a numbers game. Like I'm totally in with all these people. Whereas what I'm hearing is it might be just one person. And that conveys a sense of belonging. Is that true?
I think that's very true. I mean, I use the umbrella metaphor, you know, humorously here, but it is a serious motif that, you know, you're in a storm, an umbrella can help a lot.
Nice. Thank you so much, Jeff. Thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. And if you missed any of this episode, you can listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app or anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.